My name is Bonnie Landry. I'd like to welcome you to my podcast with my co-hosts, Elizabeth and Christina, where we explore the questions about homeschooling and family life and how we can make joy normal.
All right. Good afternoon, Christina.
Hi, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm well. Yeah, enjoying the last vestige of summer here. And it's lovely. Yeah, it's lovely. Mornings are cool. And I know you probably don't get that, but
no.
Evenings are cool. But the day is actually still really warm and lovely. So,
wow, that's like my ideal weather. But we don't get that until October, maybe November sometimes. It depends. Right. So still very much summer here. And I'm trying to accept that.
Yeah, exactly. It must be hard to start the school year. Maybe if you were raised in Texas, it wouldn't, but
yeah, it feels
like for most of us, the cool weather and the cool mornings and the sweater weather and all that kind of is this back to school mentality.
No, we don't really have that. Most schools here start in mid-August and it's still very hot here in mid-August. So I never felt that back to school, like crisp, wear your jacket kind of, I never had that experience until I went to college.
Okay, but, so I know a lot of homeschoolers start in August, and maybe it's from, maybe different states start earlier, because I was thinking, why are you starting in August when you still have...
I've always thought, you know, whenever I do start formal homeschooling, that I wouldn't start until after Labor Day, just because that's, I like that. I like the idea of September being the beginning, and it's a little less hot outside, which is nice.
And do they take a longer break? Longer summer break, like stop earlier? Or?
Most schools out in Austin or in Texas get out at the end of May or like the very first week of June, definitely not later than that, unless there's some sort of weather event that pushes school back, you know, but we don't usually get snow days or anything like that. So that would be really unusual.
Okay, interesting. I just assumed the entire world started in September and ended in June. Just for some context for our listeners, we have, like last week, we had a lot of questions come out of our episode on obedience. This is sort of part two of the answering of those questions, because I felt like it was sort of important to deal with. And we're going to produce these as a supplementary episode, probably midweek. Over the next couple of weeks, just because I think that when people have asked a question, especially about obedience, that they're kind of, you know, and some of the questions sounded a little more desperate than others, I would say. So we dealt with some of those last week and we'll do some more now. And if people continue to send questions in, we'll deal with them as they come up. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's start out with a fun one about bedtime.
Right. We discussed that at the end of
this. This is a mom who says, I don't know if it's really an obedience issue, but my kids who are 3 and 6 always want to sleep in my bed. My husband lays down with our 1.5-year-old in another room. None of it feels great for marital intimacy, but maybe good for marital chastity and NFP. Haha. But I just have a hard time figuring out whether I should have better boundaries or if I should just accept the family bed and appreciate that they won't always need that closeness. I think the obedience thing comes in play when I say, you're going to sleep in your own bed. And then my 6-year-old is scared and wants to lay with his brother and then begs to lay in my bed. Or he just tells me, no, I'm not going to sleep in my own bed.
Okay, so just a couple things that right off the top of my head is that, first of all, I don't think that we shouldn't consider being scared as an obedience issue, right? If a child is scared, they're scared. There would be a variety of ways that we could handle that.
And they're not faking it.
Yeah, but they're not faking it. Every parent knows their own child, you know, and sometimes kids will fake being scared because they've seen that that can be an effective tool. That's a sort of a deceit problem, not really a scared. So we have to sometimes discern, okay, what's the actual problem here? And if they're scared, we have to find ways of dealing with that. I'm just going to kind of lay out what we did. And I'm not saying that this is the right way or this is the only way. It just was one of those things that as we had more children and as frustration built that bedtime was taking a long time, these were some of the things that we employed because we felt they were best for our family. Every parent has to discern what's best for their own family. Here are some ideas. And sometimes for us, a lot of it was just about accepting what was, okay? So when I started off with my first 2 kids, I did not have children sleeping in bed with me. I couldn't sleep. I had been exposed to some, you know, sort of family bed through La Leche League interaction and whatnot, but I just didn't know anybody. I didn't know anybody who nursed a baby past 6 months. I didn't know anybody who had a family bed except a few La Leche League moms that I had come into contact with, and they weren't my close friends. So I hadn't had sort of intimate discussion with them about what that was like. But what I knew was that I couldn't sleep. So that's kind of where I started out. My second child was colicky and fussy through the night and whatever. And at some point, it just was so ludicrous to leave her in a crib and to get up 3 or 4 times as she was crying. You know, I was just too tired to pursue that anymore. So we just brought her into bed as a matter of practicality. When I got pregnant with the third, during my pregnancy, a study had come out about co-sleeping and cultures that co-sleep. And I'm sorry, I won't be able to, this is, you know, 27 years ago now, I won't be able to find the study, but it was a study that followed Japanese families in Japan who co-slept, who were rural families who co-slept with their children, and the incidences of crib death, that was, you know, SIDS, that almost didn't exist in those cultures. And then tracking families that moved to the Western world, moved to North America, and some of them maintained their traditional practices of co-sleeping, and some did not. And what they found was there was a huge link between the traditional practices, putting the baby in a crib. Now, that was some initial research that was done into, okay, was it actually the co-sleeping, or was it the chemicals that might have been in the mattress of the crib, or was it that the baby wasn't listening to mama's heartbeat or breathing or whatever? So it was the beginning of some pretty intensive research. Child development was one of those things that was kind of this real wake up to me that I started just rethinking the whole thing, is that I think children weren't meant to sleep alone. And I know that there are people who think that, you know, that's completely wrong, and, you know, they're welcome to their opinions. You know, there's research to support both, but I mean, in terms of brain development, certainly research, in terms of baby development is really leaning towards and there's vast amounts of research now, 27 years later, on what co-sleeping does both neurologically and from a health perspective and whatnot for our babies. So from that point on, my babies were allowed to be in our bed until they wanted to move into another room, right? And I became very comfortable with that idea, and I felt like it was very much a safety thing and a developmental thing, and I just didn't move back. So actually, the daughter who had been colicky as a baby, she's now 2, and I'm pregnant with the next one. A few months, my husband would actually lay down and go to sleep with her, because we just had this shift, kind of this paradigm shift in what matters. And so our daughters shared a room, the 2 older ones shared a room, and she, you know, would fall asleep with my husband there, and I was pregnant and then delivered my baby. And so she was in my bed, you know, forevermore, you know, well, not forevermore, she's 27 now.
But don't they never leave if you let them stay in your bed? Aren't they going to stay ever?
Yes, they actually leave on their own. And that, you know, can happen at different ages. So this is the paradigm shift that we experienced. This is what we wanted for our family. We want to co-sleep. We want a family bed. We want the children to be able to choose when they leave that situation. We felt it was the most historically well supported, that there, it's no way 100 years ago, 150 years ago, there's no way it would have been safe, a baby sleeping in a room where there was no adult present. Okay.
Yeah.
Whether it was their wet nurse or their mother or whatever, it wouldn't have been safe, because our homes, our, you know, where we lived wasn't necessarily safe from animals, from bugs, from
weather,
you know, all those things. And so.
And most people didn't have enough space.
Exactly. The vast majority of people lived in very small spaces, right? We just became very comfortable with that idea. And so from that point on, you know, we started having more kids. So eventually we had the king size bed. So that was good. We could have 1 or 2 kids in bed with us. We almost always had a sleeping bag on the floor so that if an older child who actually was sleeping in their own room had a nightmare or something, they could just come and claw, you know, climb in the sleeping bag right beside our bed. You know, so sometimes there was one child in bed with us. Sometimes there was two. There could be three kids in our room. You know, that wasn't unusual, right? Or if somebody had a nightmare, whatever, my husband might go and, you know, sleep in their bed and just cuddle up with them until they fell asleep
yeah.
and come back to bed or not. Sometimes he'd find himself. My husband always had a watch with an alarm on it because he said, I never really knew where I was going to wake up. What was building frustration in our life was not co-sleeping. What was building frustration was the fact that bedtime was taking a really long time. So because we had family prayers together, sometimes we had a bedtime snack. So I'm going to factor all these things in and call this the bedtime routine. We would like to read to our kids at night. Sometimes my husband would be holding a very small baby while I nursed an older child, or while I read to an older child, or while we just had some chance to sort of chit chat about the day or whatever. But because bedtime was taking so long, like, it, you know, would you factor in all those things, it could take an hour and a half to put kids to bed. So we sort of said, okay, after maybe with our fifth or something like that, it was like, okay, bedtime's taking a really long time. It's starting to kind of, both of us are starting to feel kind of agitated. And we started to examine what happens at bedtime, and was there anything that we could cut out that we feel like we could streamline bedtime? And ultimately, what we wanted for our children was to go to bed with happy thoughts, with some lovely time with us, with a chance to maybe deploy anything negative that had happened during their day, or anything positive also that had happened during their day. We wanted prayers to happen. We wanted bedtime reading to happen, because that was a really nice time, especially for my husband, to read to the kids. You know, I read during the day, he would read at night. We wanted it to be playful and enjoyable, and we didn't want there to be, you know, okay, it's bedtime, everybody. Okay, you know, that kind of angsty bedtime. And so we came to the conclusion that it's just going to take time, right? It's just, bedtime's just going to take time. It was just, it changed everything to just decide, okay, we're actually in the driver's seat here. We could, yeah, there's things we could do. Do we want to? No, we don't. That ultimately kind of became the way we deployed bedtime. And the funny thing is now that our kids are grown, and as they started to grow up and leave home and not require bedtime routines, you know, as they got, you know, whatever age, 7, 8, 9, 10, and they were just sort of self-propelling in a sense, that you start to miss it, right? You start to miss those long, enjoyable chit-chats, reading sessions, talking about your struggles of the day, or the big, big questions that often come at night. Mom, why did God make chickens? You know, Mom, why did God create the world the way he did and not some other way? You know, those big, big questions, or why do people have to die? Those are things we don't want to say, oh, well, you know, it's bedtime now and we can't talk about that. Now, then we might be the kind of thing is, you know what, we can talk about that for about 5 minutes and then we need to do bedtime, but we'll talk about it more in the morning, or we'll talk about it more when I get home from work tomorrow or whatever. That was what we wanted for our family. And I have no regrets that we did the bedtime the way that we did, and that it was lovely and enjoyable, and our kids didn't go to bed with angst, right? I'm really grateful. Now, I think that you could shorten bedtime and have it still not be angsty. I think that there's ways that we can do that. For example, if you want your child, like for me, because I nursed my kids for a long time, I'm going to just shock everybody here, but most of my kids nursed till they were about 5. And they, you know, because we practice self-led weaning. That said, for anyone who's like freaking out right now, 3, 4, 5-year-olds don't nurse very much, okay? You know, and sometimes it's like a couple times a week. But in general, that was how they fell asleep. And then when they stopped nursing, they just fell asleep, you know, and sometimes that was with us sitting beside them in bed, or, you know, like with a chair beside them, and I might be, you know, reading a book to myself or whatever, and they're just falling asleep on their own. Eventually, they learn to fall asleep on their own. Some kids do it right away. Some kids go immediately from the nursing relationship to like, I'm really tired now. Yeah, just need to fluff up my pillow and boom, I'm out.
Yeah.
You know, some kids require a little more
hand holding.
And so, you know, Deborah McNamara talks about sort of the bridging, where you would say, I'm going to, you know, don't forget, you know, you're going to have a sleep and you're going to have all kinds of nice dreams. And in the morning, as soon as you wake up, I'm going to hear you and I'm going to come in your room, or you're going to come and snuggle me. You create a bridge point from this moment to the next moment that we see each other.
And you focus on the reunion and not on the separation.
Exactly. That's a really important thing. One of the things that one of the tools that I had learned early on, you know, when we were sort of more getting kids to fall asleep on their own, and sometimes depending on the child, if they didn't move right from the nursing relationship into just sort of this, you know, lovely, okay, I'm ready to go to sleep now and curl up and go to sleep, that I would say, like, they would say, oh, I need a drink of water, I need a snack. And it's not about the drink of water or the snack. It's about connection. That's a really important thing to be aware of, that it's about connection. And so we say, sometimes, like, we would joke around, like, we would say, okay, I'll get you a raisin. And they would eat the raisin and then be like, oh, thank you, now I need to go to sleep. And so it's not about the snack at all. It's about your willingness to connect. If they say, for example, glass of water, you say, okay, I'm going to go get you a glass of water. I'll be back in 5 minutes. So you bring them a glass of water, and then you'll say, I'm going to come back and check on you in 5 more minutes. And then maybe you wait 10 minutes, right? And then you come back and check on them because they're expecting that. And then you come back and you'll say, I'm going to check on you in about 10 minutes. And you kind of just draw out the checking on you. They say, okay. And they're usually happy because the connection point isn't the next morning. It's in 5 minutes or in 10 minutes. In one of those increments, maybe there's two, maybe there's three, maybe when you first started, there's half a dozen. In one of those increments, they fall asleep. Sometimes they wake up in the morning and say, where did you? You didn't check on me. And you say, actually, I did check on you and you fell asleep. And what it does is it builds their confidence in that they just going to fall asleep and you're still going to check on them and you're still there and they can just fall asleep in a happy way, right?
Deborah McNamara, I suggest maybe, like, if you have a child who doesn't believe you, taking a picture of you right. with them asleep.
That's a great idea.
Or leaving them a little note every time you check in on them and putting it by their pillow so in the morning they can see all the notes that you left them when you were checking on them. Those can be kind of reassuring for a child who's not really sure you're actually checking on them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, no, I really did this. Or sometimes they'll doze off and they'll wake up, you know, and they think, oh, you didn't check on me, but oh, actually, yeah, I did. She's got a couple of good articles on bedtime as well. So I'm just jotting a note down here to put that in the show notes. And I've got a big long blog post where I sort of outline our bedtime routine. And, you know, maybe it sounds ludicrous, but it was a no frustration bedtime. And that was what was lovely about it. They were flexible. It wasn't like, because the kids knew how we operated at bedtime, say we were staying in a hotel or say we were staying overnight at someone's house or whatever, that we would say, you know, bedtime's going to look different tonight. We're going to pray with this other family and then I'll sit with you while you're falling asleep. But it's going to look a little different tonight because we don't have our book and we don't have this. And I think because they were really, really secure in how bedtime rolled, that they weren't worried that this was somehow going to mean that we were abandoning them in some way or something like that, right? That, you know, then we're going to stay up and have a grown-up visit and I'll come to, you know, I'm sleeping in your room or I'm sleeping in the next room or whatever. No, so I think there was just a security that happened and it was comfortable.
When you think about separation being the most anxiety-producing event for a child, separation from their parents specifically. I mean, bedtime represents 10 to 12 hours of separation. Mm-hmm. And that's a little scary, especially if you're not certain that your parent is right there or that you're going to be able to call and they will come or what have you.
Yeah.
I highly recommend if you want to read studies on safe bed sharing, co-sleeping, especially with babies, if you're curious about that, Professor James McKenna at Notre Dame has this mother baby sleep lab that he's the only person in the world who's done this.
Cool.
And he has an actual lab where he studies moms co-sleeping with their babies. Mm. And he also has a huge database of all these studies and all of these, I'm sure the Japan study is in there that you referred to.
Interesting.
And he also has he has a whole book called Safe Infant Sleep that's all about safe co-sleeping practices, because there are dangerous ways that you can share bed share with your baby. A lot of times when people hear about deaths related to bed sharing, people confuse, they think there's some sort of correlation between SIDS and bed sharing when, like you said, it's mm-hmm. actually the opposite. Mm-hmm. Deaths from bed sharing tend to be accidental, related to intoxication, related to, you know, mother or father being a smoker. I mean, there's all kinds of things that, like, contraindications for bed sharing with an infant. that you need to know about if you're planning on bed sharing with your baby. But most parents will end up bed sharing at some point, especially in the baby's first year of life. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that many people are told, just don't do it. Like, it's so dangerous. Don't do it. If you do it, you're going to kill your baby.
So we think we're doing something harmful. I know. Yeah.
And so people end up doing it unsafely. Like, they end up bed sharing, but not really bed sharing, sharing a couch with a baby when they're asleep, or a recliner. That's much more dangerous than sleeping on a flat surface, a bed, you know, like actually intentionally bed sharing. We just decided it's way easier.
Yeah, exactly. And they will go through phases, right? Where they... I'd like to move back, if we can, for a moment about the act getting kids to bed, or dealing with that, just because the question was less about bed sharing and more about sort of getting kids to cooperate. So I think it'd be good to sort of jump back for a moment. Our listeners have heard me talk about this idea of the get off your butt parenting. Okay. And I'm going to bring this in. So get off your butt parenting, I'll just do a little refresh, is not about, okay, you're a lazy parent, get off your butt. It's nothing to do with that. It's talking about active parenting. Okay. So if we are sitting there having an expectation that our kids are going to respond to a directive that we are giving them when they don't want to do a thing, that's an unrealistic expectation. For example, go back to bed. Well, if a kid is scared or not wanting to go to bed or feeling obstinate or whatever, and we just say, go back to bed or brush your teeth or come on, hurry up and get your pajamas on. If we're just kind of badgering them in a sense, we're putting them in the driver's seat. Okay. And so that's one of the things about get off your butt parenting that I think is really, really important, that we are responsive in a very physical, active way with our kids. For example, if we want them to go back to bed, there is a gentle, appropriate, much more effective way than to be saying, go back to bed. Okay. So that is getting up, leading the child back to bed, saying, this is actually your bed and this is where I would like you to sleep. And I'm going to sit with you for a minute. Whatever the issue is, you might want to find out, were they scared? Were they whatever? And you might handle it, you know, differently according to that response. But maybe they just woke up and had to pee or something like that. And they, you know, now, okay, now we're going to go back to bed. And I'm going to tuck you in. I'm going to kiss you. And I'm going to see you in just a couple of hours because it's almost morning time, right? So there's a gentle, appropriate way you can do it, but it is active. Because we could say, and that's what builds frustration. It's the repeating ourselves and come on, guys, come on, guys, come on, you guys. That's so frustration inducing for parents, right? So that's another thing, is come on, get your pajamas on. Get your pajamas on. Say it one time and then just scoop the child up and say, actually it's pajama time, you know, on with your pajama pants, on with your diaper, on with your whatever, you know, actually it's pajama time, and do it. Follow it up with an action as opposed to a directive that you're looking weak and ineffective because you keep saying the same thing over and over and again. The child's not responding because they don't want to do it.
Very applicable to potty training also.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's active. Brush your teeth. I said, brush your teeth. Just get your toothbrush and brush your teeth. No, brush your teeth. If they're actually old enough to brush their teeth, it's something, maybe they've even been doing it for a few months or whatever, and they're not responding because they don't want to go to bed. If that's the problem, or they're distracted by something else kids are doing or whatever, that we actually just put the toothpaste on their toothbrush and we stand them at the sink and we, okay, I'm just going to brush your teeth because it's not getting done and it's important that we get it done now. End of story. Even if a child has been doing something for a while, and most nights they do it without you being active, because ultimately, if a child can brush their teeth independently, they do want to do that. But there's going to be nights where they drag their feet or whatever. And so now they know, oh, okay, my teeth are going to get brushed anyway. If I don't like dad brushing my teeth, I'll just do it myself, because they're going to do, it's going to get done whether I like it or not. You know, and maybe they're screaming, maybe they're crying, oh yeah, I just got to brush these teeth, you know, and can't ask 10 times, so I'm asking once. And it's, but that can be handled in a really appropriate, I'm in charge, I'm the adult, and this is the thing we're doing now. We're just going to move forward, right? And, you know, you might kick and thrash and scream, and I don't have to get ruffled up about that. We get much more ruffled by the repeated requests. And then that's when the threats start too. If you don't do X, if you don't brush your teeth now, I'm going to blah. If you don't brush your teeth now, I'm going to, you know, X, Y, Z. It's just so, it's an ineffective parenting method.
It's okay sometimes to be like, you know what? We don't have to brush our teeth tonight. let's just.
Yeah, if you've stayed up really late or they've just had a meltdown or, you know, we just have to be sensitive to that.
Well, one thing I realized once when my son was two, before he was really verbal and able to really tell us what was going on, he all of a sudden, out of nowhere, seemingly, just was so averse to getting his teeth brushed. We were really mystified about it. We were trying to kind of hold him down and do it. And what we realized the next day was that he had a cold sore. Aww. Under his lip until I knew he finally was able to point to it and show me what was going on. But I was at first, I was like, what is the deal? Why is he fighting this? It's so, yes. You know, this is something we've been doing every night. Like, I thought we were past this. There was a reason. Yeah. And sometimes when a kid is really, 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 really resistant, like not just average counter will, but like over the top, melting down.
And out of character. Sometimes there's a reason.
There might be something else going on.
Or they're getting an ear infection or whatever. Yeah. So did we sort of cover, do you think we sort of covered all the, because that was sort of a.
Well, the one thing that you didn't talk about was like, if you decide that you want to streamline your bedtime and part of that is having at least a couple of your kids sleeping in your room, or that you want to keep the invitation open to your children. Like, if you need to come and sleep with us, if you get up in the middle of the night and you want to come to our room, that's fine. You know, you're always welcome, that sort of thing. In your experience, death to your marital intimacy. Because I think there's a lot of people who are afraid that if they keep the door open to their children, that means bye-bye marriage and marital health.
Right. I never found that to be an issue. I mean, I sort of often have gone back to my life and, okay, well, what would they have done in the village, right? If, you know, traditional communities, traditional villages, what would they have done? Well, what we know is that small children and older children slept usually in the same room with their parents. And so there has to be a way. Well, you know, we can creatively find ways, and that's okay. We can creatively find ways to experience our intimacy without either disrupting sleep or not being overly concerned about a small child. We've always had a lock on our bedroom door because
yeah.
It was older children that was more of a concern for me. I didn't want somebody walking in. That mattered to me. And we would lock our door and then open the door, you know, when we were ready to go to sleep for the night. For millennia, intimacy has happened in a variety of situations, much less privately than we consider it to be appropriate now. I'm quite private on that level about sexuality, but it's not something that I want anyone walking in on. And at the same time, if there's a baby in my bed or a toddler in my bed, you know, I know if they're sleeping soundly or not. They sleep with me every night. If they're not sleeping soundly, this is a moment of intimacy that I don't want to say, actually, I feel like this child is too wakeful or too kind of light sleeping right now. You know, there's other rooms in my house and that's okay. You know, sorry to be, you know, blunt, but.
That's one of the advantages of having more space than our forebears did, is that you can go to another room.
We had that option available to us. There's just not a problem there. I think a lot of times too, is that intimacy, especially for women, really begins, this is such a not homeschooling topic, but it is because family life really begins when we're talking together on the couch. You know, it doesn't start in the bedroom generally, right? It starts because, you know, of a conversation we're having or a closeness that we feel. It's not like it's suddenly just, oh, ding, we're in bed now. That's when the intimacy bell goes off. We don't need to be so narrow about intimacy, because that's a very new, last probably, you know, 50, 80 years problem, and a new world problem too. It's, you know, I mean, there are just so many people in so many places that experience probably far healthier intimacy than we do in a much more confined or less private situation, right?
Yeah, that's so true. And that helps me to remember, because I think it's so easy to get really narrow focused on just this culture and what's normal in our culture and not think outside the box. All right. Well, what about a question related to obeying other adults? So how do you get a child to obey? For example, let's say he's going to school. Obviously, most of the people listening are homeschooling, but even if it's obeying a grandparent or obeying an aunt and uncle, someone who's in charge of them for a period of time and you're not necessarily around, what do you do to encourage them to listen and cooperate with other adults who are trustworthy and who you want them to cooperate with?
Yeah. So let's assume first that the parents have actually verbally to the child and to the adult passed off their authority to keep the child safe and to have an environment where the child's going to listen to you. And that's overtly stated. Okay, so I don't think we should ever expect our child to obey another adult if that transaction has not expressly and overtly happened. And I think that to set a child up that you just obey adults, that's a very scary situation that you could be putting the child in. Now, maybe you're thinking in your brain, you're thinking, you know, their grandparents and their teachers and whatever, you obey other adults, and that's what you're trying to give them, but it might put them in a position of being afraid to say no in a situation that could be very compromising. I'll just use an example from my own life with my own daughters, who are really amazing. My grandchildren are here overtly saying, if you have a problem, you know, you need to tell Mamie what it is, or if you're thirsty or hungry, you need to tell Mamie what it is. Or if Mamie asks you to do something or not do something, you need to listen every time. It's not just a blanket thing, because I don't feel it's my place to step in to discipline their kids ever, really. And I think that we can actually avoid disciplining the children a lot if our goal, okay, what's the goal here? Say, I'm just going to give a couple of scenarios because I find it easier to work in that framework. So say the kids come over here and that has happened. There's this transaction has happened. Is that Mamie is the person that's in charge. She's the adult in charge right now. I'm going to not be here. So you need to listen. You need to, you know, ask, you need to whatever. And she's also the person who's going to take care of your needs while I'm not here. Cause both those things, we have to be aware of both of those things. So say my grandkids are doing something that I feel is unsafe. I don't need to discipline them about that. I can manage the environment. I can say, actually, we're not playing in this place. We need to move you over here. I mean, so very much in the same way that I was with my own kids. I mean, you are discipling them because you're saying, this is not what we do here. And I'm putting you over here now because this isn't a safe situation. So I'm not meeting out any kind of punishment, or I'm not even necessarily talking to them about it. I'd be much more inclined to just manage the environment, move the child, you know, from one place to another, and say the reason why we're doing this is because this isn't safe. And this is something I have to say no about, right? Or something that I'm choosing to say no about. But I might say, you know, we had a situation here where the kids kept going on grandpa's tractor, right? So I might say something like, I need to talk to your parents about the tractor and what we're going to do about that, because it isn't something, it's not safe for you guys to play on the tractor. So what do we do about that? So I'm going to take that to the parents. So for the moment, they're very young. My grandkids are very young. So either I'm going to make sure I have a visual on them at all times if they're at my house and they're not being supervised, or I'm going to make sure the parents do, or we're going to manage the environment in some way that they can't access the tractor. At this moment in time, I'm saying, you know, this is not something we can do. This is a really important thing for you to listen about, for me to know that you're safe, right? This is something we have to keep you safe about. But I'm also going to say, okay, parents, you know, this is something we need to talk to the kids about and find a way of managing the situation, because the tractor is a pretty attractive thing. So if they're not listening about it, and they're all under, you know, five and under, so they're impulse driven, right? So how are we going to manage this differently? There might be another thing. Say a 3-year-old or 2-year-old is dumping their food on the table. Or one of the rules I have in my house is we don't walk around to eat. And I always had it with my kids, and I have it with the grandkids as well. You know, we eat at the table. If they want a cookie or if they want a snack or whatever, I'll always say, yep, you just take that up to the table or outside. Right. So if they keep getting up and wandering around with it, it's something that as with my own kids, I don't need to say, I told you not to blah, blah, blah. Say, actually, we're going to have that at the table and put it back at the table. If they get up another time or two, I might say, okay, I'm just going to put this away for the time being. When you're ready to sit at the table, we can, I'll bring that back for you, but you can go play now. I don't make a disciplinary measure out of it. So teachers is a bit of a different situation, because a teacher has to be able to have authority in a classroom. So I think, first of all, parents need to recognize that when we put our kids in school, we are kind of contracting out discipline to that teacher. And that is appropriate. We can't leave the teacher powerless to discipline. But I'd want to be pretty aware of how discipline goes down in any particular given situation. And that's something that, if I had put my kids in school, I'd have been really, really clear with both the philosophy of the school and the philosophy of the teacher on what discipline looks like in that situation, because discipline may not be handled how I want it, and that may affect my decision to put the child in that place. If we want our children to obey adults, we need to be putting them in the hands of adults that they trust, adults that they feel comfortable with, adults that are respectful, adults that have a similar philosophy, or at least are in agreement with your philosophy. For example, say your child was in daycare 2 days a week where you worked or something. If that daycare worker, maybe they have different disciplinary methods that they use. But if they respect that that's not something that you do, say, for example, timeouts. If they respect that, okay, I don't do timeouts and it's not how I want discipline handled, either you find a new daycare worker who doesn't use that, or you know that that daycare worker is willing to look at some options that you might use. I think we need to be really, really clear with the people we put in charge of our kids. And my own mom was not on the same page at all with me about discipline. And I loved her to pieces and I wanted her to spend time with her grandchildren. I came to a place where when they were very young, I did not. Because like when they were at the impulsive stage, so she would, my mom was really good with babies and she was really good with older kids. But there was a certain sort of age range that I did not leave them with her to babysit my kids. If I had things to do, I either took that child with me or we went and just visited while I was there or whatever, because I didn't want to put my kids in a situation where she was handling discipline in a way that I felt was wrong. We just had to come to an agreement. Well, it never was an agreement, really. Like with my own mama, she didn't understand what I did. She felt that it was condoning behavior to discipline the way that we did, is that, that behavior is not okay. And we need to talk about how we need to see this roll out in the future. She felt that was condoning their behavior and she couldn't.
Yeah, because you're not spanking or punishing. You're just.
So that was just something that we had to move past. And so it just was one of those things that most of the quality time my kids spent with my mom was either with me present or when they were a little older.
Right? Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And I think that's such an important thing. With coaches are another one that I would be really vigilant about, knowing how the discipline works, because that world, the athletic world, can get kind of scary on the discipline front.
Absolutely. So you want to know, as a parent, you be present, right? If you have any concerns, that you be present, especially if they're in sports when they're very young.
And your children can tell if you trust an adult that you're leaving them with, or if you're not sure about that person being an authority in your child's life, they're not going to be sure about it either. Again, this idea of matchmaking that Deborah McNamara and Gordon Neufeld have, where if you're going to leave your child with someone else, you have to matchmake them first. You have to make the connection. You have to kind of be the bridge between yourself, your child, and that other adult, so that they know you trust this person, so they can trust this person.
And a couple of thoughts on that, actually, because I think it's really important, is the more secure your child is in their relationship with you, the more they're going to trust the adults that you trust. That's a really important thing to bear in mind, that, if they're concerned that you might not make the best choices for them, if that's a concern of theirs as a little person, it's going to be much harder to put them in the charge of another adult. So in their security, they find security. The other thing is that I think it really speaks to this idea that, like, when your grandkids are born, or nieces and nephews and that sort of thing, like, there's this familial relationship, and babies, very young babies, pick up on that. And it's a fascinating thing as a grandparent, because they're such part of you. Like, you're not raising them, you're not disciplining them, you're not nursing them, you're not whatever. And yet they come to you. You're a step down from their mother, but you are so much in their circle of trust. And I think it's because of the way their parents interact with you, that there's this lovely familial interaction that provides an environment where the baby doesn't question that this is a person that they might need to be nervous around. And it's a fascinating thing to watch, actually, that they just kind of know.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful testament to your relationship with your kids, because that's not necessarily something that every child, every adult child experiences. You know, they don't necessarily feel like they can trust their children with, like you were saying with your mom, there is a level of insecurity there between you and the mother. So there's not going to be this seamless, like, of course, this is like my second mom. This is, it's not going to be as obvious to the child necessarily.
Yeah. So, I would say, great caution in the adults that we choose, and certainly opportunities to bridge in those relationships and allow the child the opportunity to get to know you, or to get to know that person, or get to know that you trust them. And I would never, caution people to never, ever leave your child with somebody that you have any question marks, even if you have reviews from other people, or just go with your gut instinct, and that's sometimes hard, because it's hard to trust other people with our children. But if there's a gut thing going on that you feel like, I'm just not sure if this is a good match, maybe there's nothing actually wrong with the person, but maybe they don't, you sense that they're not going to get you or your child, right? And so those are important things to bear in mind.
For me, the most important thing is that someone I leave my child with knows they can handle it. Like they're confident that they can take care of my child. There's no like, well, what if he does this? What am I going to do? Because children pick up on that. If you don't feel comfortable with them, they're not going to feel comfortable with you.
Exactly. Sort of confidence. Yeah. Are there more questions?
There are.
Okay.
But we're pretty close to time. So do you want to wait and answer those next time? Or do you want to just kind of finish them real quick?
If you think they'd be sort of quick type questions.
Well, they're all kind of in the same vein.
Okay.
And they're all related to toddlers.
Okay.
I think we could do that.
Sure. Okay. Let's chat about toddlers.
If I ask my 2-year-old to give me something that he has, he will immediately throw it. Something that he doesn't have. Sometimes I ask my 4-year-old to do something she doesn't want to do. She will point her finger in my face and scream at me.
Right.
For reference, I don't scream or point in her face. So it's not my model.
I like that qualification. That's important to know.
Yeah. 3, if I take too long talking to another adult, my 4-year-old will sometimes scream until I stop talking. Right. I think these are all basically the same question.
They are similar for sure. First of all, as we've talked about quite a bit over these last couple of episodes, is that this is the age group where they are totally impulse driven. And so that doesn't mean the behavior's okay. Doesn't mean we don't deal with the behavior. It's just that if we know that, it will help us to deal with it in a more appropriate way. That's, it's that simple. So there was pointing in the face, throwing it, and screaming
right. When you're talking to another adult.
Yeah. So I think a couple of things are just really important to note. First of all, they're impulse driven. So what do we do about that a behavior that's inappropriate? So I would say, if you know a child is likely to throw something, I would just say something as simple as, you put your hand on the child's hand that's holding the object, and you say, give that to mommy. And you if they don't just give it to you, then you actually take it from them, depending on the reasons why you're getting them to give it to you. But say, for example, you don't want them holding that thing, or you're trying to get them to put it away, or whatever, or if it's unsafe, don't give them the opportunity to throw it. Hand over it, and you just gently take it out of their hand, or you allow them the opportunity to kind of release. But if they don't, it's okay to pry their fingers off of it. That's all right, as long as we're kind. Oh, no, you have to give that to mommy now because it's not safe. Don't give them the opportunity to throw it. So again, it's the act, it's very active. We're right there. We're asking for the thing in proximity. Our hand is on it. The opportunity is not there to throw. So it's very active. It's very tactile, I guess, in a sense. The same thing with the screaming in the face, that I would say, if, was that because she was saying no to the child about something?
Yeah.
Okay. So the child is going to scream at you no. Okay. So first of all, how are you framing the question? Is it, would you like to put your toys away now? Don't frame it like that, right? Then they might still respond with no. You could say, it's time to put the toys away. I wouldn't, if the child is going to scream in my face, if that was a habit that they're going through right now, I would not put myself in a position where they could scream in my face. There's one of two ways you could do this. One is I would be standing up and saying, we need to do this thing now so that the blast of someone screaming in my face didn't happen. And if they insist that you pick them up, or you know that they're trying to get up in a chair or something like that so they can be in your face screaming, that you just say, no, I don't want to be screamed at in my face, so we're not doing that. Place yourself in a position physically where the child can't scream in your face. The alternative to that would actually be been screaming in my face when I ask you to do something. And that's not something we do in our house. You're talking very quietly. Maybe you pull the child up onto your lap and say, I'm going to ask something of you. You're priming them, right? I'm going to ask something of you, and you might make you feel like you need to scream in your face. Maybe you could let me know. If you feel like screaming, you could let me know. Or you just bring them in into a very, very quiet place, then you ask them the thing and see if that tempers the screaming. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it would be something worth trying, because of course they're going to outgrow. But in the meantime, what do we do with that? I would say again, physically. So if they have screamed in your face and you want them to, how do I provide discipline, discipleship, guidance for this particular behavior? We don't scream at people in our house, or screaming at people is upsetting. When I want to communicate with you, it's important that we just talk in normal voices, right? Or whatever. There's lots of different ways you could
phrase
that.
When you scream, it's hard for me to understand what you're saying. Exactly. That's one that I use.
Yeah. And so there's many ways we can approach that without it being a reaction. My default was, we don't do that. You might have to spend 2 months saying, we don't do that. Is there some other way you could speak so that I can understand you better? Pull them up on your lap. There doesn't even has to be a judgment, but it could be the kind of thing. At two, probably not worth it, but it could be the kind of thing that, you know, later on, if they were a little bit older, that you could pull them up on your lap and say, you sounded so angry earlier when you were screaming. Were you happy screaming or angry screaming? Probably it was angry screaming, but it gives them an opportunity to explore maybe why they were screaming at you. And also, Is there something fundamentally going on that's creating screaming? Like the child is maybe not feeling that you're attending. And this, I'm not making any judgment here, because children can do these things and we have done nothing wrong or nothing to deserve it. It's really important to note. But sometimes it'll be at a period of our life where we're quite distracted. Maybe we have a new baby and we're nursing a lot, or maybe we have some other thing going on in our life that's distracting. So children can do these behaviors without this, but it's important, I think, to spend a moment or two. Is there something going on in their life with me or with them? Maybe they're just going through a developmental hiccup. And I found my kids became frustrated when they were often on the brink of learning something new, learning to ride a bike, learning to read, learning to whatever. There was often this sort of period of time for a couple of weeks or a couple of months that they would be agitated. And I didn't even know why until I cycled through a few kids and I realized, like, oh, they just learned how to read. Oh, they just learned how to ride a bike. They just learned how to whatever, something, you know, fairly big, you know, and that's often sort of coincides with the 5-7 switch. So that, you know, there's a lot of frustrations going through this new phase of life. Or potty training. That was another one where angst just happened. Even if you're not putting any angst on them, that they are anxious simply because they're trying to remember that they need to pee in a different way than they used to. And so they can just go through angst about that. And of course, then we respond with angst often.
Yes. Oh gosh.
Yeah. So do you think that covers it? I was going to mention one other thing. The child who is pointing.
It was pointing and screaming.
Pointing and screaming. Did we cover all of them?
No, the third one was when they get really upset that you're talking to another adult.
There's this really lovely tool that a friend of mine was telling me about, and apparently it's kind of a Montessori-ism. I wish I had it when I had little kids, because it's a really, really smart idea, and my grandkids have started to do this. That if you're talking to another adult, this is something we teach them, and something that you practice with them, okay? So you come and put your hand on my arm. And when I notice that your hand is on my arm, I'll lay my hand over top of your hand. So you put your hand on me so that I know you want to talk to me. And then I'll put my hand on top so it knows. And the signal is, I've heard you, and I'll find a pause in the conversation so that I can talk to you. Whether it's something they want to add to the conversation, or they have to tell you they have to go to the bathroom. But you don't make them wait very long, right? So with little children, don't make them wait 5 minutes with your hand over theirs. That they put their hand, maybe they're two and they're doing this, or three. They put their hand on your arm. You notice opposite. You put your hand over theirs, and then you say, excuse me, to the adult, my son is letting me know that he would like to speak to me. So just one moment, please. You address the question, the comment, the whatever it is, and then you can go back to your adult conversation. But it's such a beautiful, gentle, lovely way of teaching a child that they need to wait, you know, maybe it's 5 seconds to start with. They could wait for 30 seconds or a minute as they grow into it and get a little older. But and at some point, they're not going to need to do that anymore. They know that just by standing near you, that you're going to respond and say, did you need me for something? Or were you just listening to the conversation? And sometimes they'll say, oh no, I was just standing here because it was interesting at 10 or whatever. They can say, actually, I just need to know, do we have permission to pull out this game or whatever. We don't keep them waiting for a long time. They know that we're responsive.
That's great advice.
Yeah, it's a lovely tool.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Thank you so much, Bonnie, for your wisdom and sharing all of your experience. I know I'm not the only woman who is benefiting, so God bless you for being so open. And
thank you so much. And I just want to say too, we received a lot of messages and questions and whatnot, accompanied with those questions that people asked over the last couple of episodes, were these beautiful messages about how people's lives have been touched in some way or another by this podcast and by listening, and they've felt more grounded as parents and various other things. We've just received so many messages over the last couple of weeks that have been really beautiful and really encouraging for us to continue, you know, pursuing this path, and for me personally to continue the podcast, because I just feel like sometimes I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but I think that really it is what we need. We just need to be over and over again, be told, you know, everything's going to be just fine. And, you know, if that's my job to do that, then I'm grateful for that opportunity to that.
It really helps, Bonnie. Thank you.
Yeah. And those messages are so helpful. So thank you. God bless. And we will talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Okay.